Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's Olly.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to the New Books Network's Middle East Studies podcast. I'm Ruben Silverman, a researcher at Stockholm University's Institute for Turkish Studies, and with me today is Timur Hammond, an assistant professor in the Department of Geography and the Environment at Syracuse University. Today we'll be discussing his new book, Placing Islam, Geographies of Connection in 20th Century Istanbul, which was published by University of California Press in 2023 and looks closely at how different individuals, groups, and institutions have sought to place Islam by making and transforming the neighborhood of Eyüp. So, the first question I'd like to ask you is to tell a little bit about yourself and your background. What brought you to these topics of Islam, Istanbul, and Eyüp? Why do you think looking at Islam in a particular location is helpful for our thinking?
Yeah, thanks for these questions. So a quick way of introducing myself is I'm a cultural and urban geographer who studies how cities are experienced and understood. But I also like to think of myself as very much a sort of interdisciplinary scholar who researches and engages with historians, with art historians, with cultural studies people, with people who do literature. So I'd like to think my project is very much a sort of interdisciplinary engagement with these questions. I actually finished undergrad as an English major and creative writing minor, and was nudged sort of very gently into geography by a faculty member at the time, or a faculty mentor at the time. But what this means is that my first encounter with Eyüp, I've been going to Istanbul for decades. I have a family connection there, a family connection to Turkey. And so I'd been to Istanbul a couple times as a child, as a sort of teenager, and later on in my 20s. But my first encounter with Eyüp was actually shaped by Orhan Pamuk's memoir, Istanbul, Memories in the City. Wrote about that memoir for my master's thesis. Like a lot of master's theses, not terribly memorable. But Pamuk talks about Eyüp at one point in there. And I was really struck. And I was like, you know, this way that Pamuk talked about Eyüp, the way that he talked about Islam, didn't seem entirely consistent with my experiences and my understanding of the place. And so it became a point of departure for me. Why is looking at Islam geographically useful for our thinking? I think this is, you will probably keep coming back to this question as over the course of our conversation, but one of the guiding questions for my work is, how is it that people construct geographies of Islam? Like, how do they figure out where it is in the world? And one of the arguments I try to make in the book is that when people often think about geography, they imagine it to be a kind of container within which everything takes place. So we imagine that we are somehow in space, and that space is a container with various dimensions. One of the interventions my book tries to make is instead thinking about geography through the metaphor of connections. So understanding places where we are in the world is always formed through these acts of connection that link us to other places, times, and objects in complicated and shifting ways.
Hmm. Well, that makes a lot of sense. And I think you're right. We will come back to these connections in just a moment, and AOOP in particular in just a moment. But maybe we can talk for a second also about one of your big analytic frameworks that you use throughout the book, which is this idea of building stories, you call it. Now, this term building stories, it has multiple meanings and maybe implications for how we can think about the relationships you're talking about between people, places, and Islam. But can you talk about some of these implications, some of these meanings that you mean by building stories?
Yeah. So thanks for this question. I mean, it really, it's something that helped me at least think about organizing the book, about the kinds of arguments that I was trying to make. And so there are a couple things that I think the concept pulls together. So the first of them is a conversation that's happening within Islamic studies, that's happening within history, that's happening within anthropology, within geography, that has to do with the materiality of storytelling, the materiality of meaning. So although this work takes a variety of forms, one of the key sort of interventions and contributions that it makes is that the meaning of things is actually shaped by and mediated by the materiality of things. So when we're not simply studying narratives, ideas, cultures, cultural histories, but we're also thinking about the role that materiality of objects like pamphlets or documents, art objects, all of these things sort of shape the materiality of how stories come to matter. One of the things that I try to do in the book is think about buildings as one type of object that mediates these stories. So in one sense, building stories is an analytic that calls our attention to the role that buildings, the built environment, plays in transmitting stories, narratives, ideas about who people are and where they find themselves. But a second theme that it pulls on is one, again, that art historians do especially well, but also anthropologists. And that has to do with kind of thinking critically about the ways that we narrate the history of buildings. So there's one approach, and the work of the anthropologist Nadia Abulhaj, I think, makes this very clear, that sees buildings as sort of facts on the ground. And there's a way that says, well, a building is there, it just is, and its meaning is fixed. This is one of the reasons why buildings are so important. But as Nadia Abulhaj does so effectively in thinking about Jerusalem, and as I try to do in thinking about AOOP in particular, what we need is a sort of critical project that looks at how meanings, narratives, ideas about buildings are actually produced, transmitted, and communicated in the first place. So there's the second way that building stories works. And then third, there's been a conversation within geography in particular over the past, say, decade or so, that's really turned to stories and storytelling as a new kind of analytic. And so here we could say there's a narrative in the 1990s. Geographers and others were often talking about discourses. Then as the 90s go along, early 2000s, we start to talk about narratives. And in a variety of ways, the past decade has seen this like really just explosion of scholarship that has turned to stories and storytelling as an analytic. And so this is really important for me. But one of the things that I try to do is think a little bit between this idea of story and then the Turkish word that I use, a rivayet, or in Arabic, riwaya, which is not exactly a story, but there's a kind of interesting and productive overlap, but also a sort of gap between those two that I think helps to speak back to the sort of Anglophone assumptions about discourses, narratives, and stories, and works within a different tradition, and particularly an Islamic tradition, to think about the acts of transmission and narration that form these traditions of Islam.
Well, let's get into some examples of this. But first, for listeners who may or may not be familiar with AOOP, let's set the stage a bit. Can you give us a thumbnail introduction to AOOP, what we might hear in Lonely Planet or in Wikipedia, and then also maybe point out some of the things that are missed in those type of familiar descriptions we get of a place like AOOP?
Yeah. So if we kind of imagine our map of Istanbul, you know, Istanbul, the city on two continents, and was divided by the Bosphorus between. So you're looking at a map, you've got the Bosphorus, to your left is the European shore, to the right is the Anatolian shore. So then if you're on the European shore, there's that second spur of water, the Golden Horn, that sort of separates the old peninsula of Istanbul from the districts of Galata, Beyoğlu, Taksim, Beşiktaş, everywhere to the north along that shore. And so that golden horn, as it moves to the west, as it moves to the left, will sort of taper out eventually. And Ayup is a neighborhood, the old Ayup is a neighborhood along the Golden Horn, on the southern end of the Golden Horn, just outside the Byzantine land walls. So in sort of classical Ottoman Istanbul, it's not actually part of Istanbul proper. It's part of the three suburbs along with Galata and Üsküdar, sort of organized in that different category. It's important for two reasons. First, it is definitely part of this old Ottoman Istanbul. It has a dense cluster of mosques, medreses, tombs, cemeteries, Sufi lodges, and civil architecture. So there's a really sort of important kind of historical richness there. The street pattern is very much, at least in the center of the district, is very much built around that older Ottoman tradition. And then second, and this is sort of the core of the book's argument, is it's a center of Muslim Istanbul. It is arguably one of the most, if not the most important Muslim pilgrimage destination, because of the person who is buried at the center of the mosque of Ayyub Sultan, who is Khalid bin Zayd Ebu Ayyub al-Ansari, who is a companion of the Prophet Muhammad, who is a companion is a Sahabe, in Arabic Sahaba. These are people who kind of interacted with the Prophet Muhammad during the Prophet's life. Khalid bin Zayd was part of the one of the Arab armies who comes and lays a siege to Istanbul in the 7th century, and he dies outside the city walls. It's the miraculous rediscovery of his body in 1453 that's sort of taken by the Ottomans as religious sanction for the capture of Istanbul. And depending on the history you read, sort of inspires the army or sort of plays a big part in, as Çiğdem Kafesçioğlu has pointed out, turning Constantinople into Istanbul. So these two parts of Ayyub as a important part of sort of physical heritage site, a part of old Istanbul, and Ayyub's crucial religious importance are often the ways that the two primary ways that people will talk about Ayyub and why it's important. So if you read a Lonely Planet guidebook, you'll often find that. But these ways of narrating Ayyub's history miss a few things. First, it tends to emphasize, I think overemphasize, the Ottoman past, and really one portion of the Ottoman past, at the expense of the district's 20th century history. So my book very intentionally focuses not on the Ottoman Ayyub, but on 20th century Ayyub, because I think it speaks back to that, offers a corrective to that tendency to sort of focus only on the Ottoman past. Second, this way of sort of just explaining Ayyub's history or significance tends to obscure the work of transmission. Like, how do people learn about this? How do they write stories? How do they publish books? How do they transmit this meaning across time and through various communities? And third, it tends to obscure the debates within and between people, both Ayyub residents, but Istanbul residents more broadly, Turks, non-Turks more broadly, about how history and Islam should be understood in the first place. So rather than think of these categories are sort of fixed and unchanging, one of the things I try to do in the book is kind of add some complexity and sort of shed some light on some of the debates over how Islam, how Khalid bin Zayd, how this district in particular should matter in the urban life of Istanbul's residents.
Well, indeed, in the beginning of the book, you start out by looking at several different stories that are told about Ayyub, about Khalid bin Zayd. So maybe you could give us a few examples of these stories and how they try to connect to different times and places and understandings of what Ayyub means and what it means for being a Muslim, to give us some examples of what you're talking about.
So there are a bunch of different stories in the book, and these stories continue to be told. One of my favorite stories, and for me, like a really, again, an interesting point of departure, is an essay written by Yahya Kemal Beyatlı, or Yahya Kemal, while Istanbul is under occupation. So in these series of essays that I think are later republished in the book Aziz Istanbul, these are essays that involve Yahya Kemal traveling through the city's peripheral districts often, and writing about the Muslim worlds, particularly writing about Islamic landscapes in these sort of rural, or not rural, but in these peripheral districts of Istanbul. I first learned about Kemal's work through Orhan Pamuk. He's, in Pamuk's memoir, Yahya Kemal is one of the sort of four Istanbul writers that Pamuk is sort of writing himself into conversation with. And so I sort of always had Yahya Kemal Beyatta on my radar. And this this essay that he writes, The Eyüp That We Saw in a Dream, Bir Rüyada Gördüğümüz Eyüp, always struck me as this really kind of interesting story. You know, he makes a very conscious decision to sort of place this tomb, place this figure of Khalid bin Zayd at the center of Istanbul's importance, which of course, that kind of storytelling in the context of Istanbul's occupation is absolutely a political project. He's telling a story about the conquest of Istanbul, the capture of a Christian Constantinople by Muslim armies at the very same moment that Mustafa Kemal is leading the war for independence in Anatolia and approaching Istanbul. So for me, there seemed to be this obvious resonance of like telling Khalid bin Zayd's story, telling this as a story of conquest, of the story of Fatih Sultan Mehmet, as a story of sort of Janissary inspirations, seemed to be very much connected to the political project, the political and cultural agenda in 1920s Istanbul.
That makes a lot of sense. I was just going to ask if maybe you can contrast that with one of the other examples you give. The one that I was thinking about was Muhammad Emin Yildirim's public lecture, 50, 60 years after. I mean, how do you see these type of stories as connecting with each other or contrasting?
Yeah, so there, I mean, this becomes the interesting thing is that the story of Khalid bin Zayd has been told time and time and time and time again over centuries, really. And so in some ways, the book is an effort to sort of tease out important and interesting differences in how these stories are told. So, you know, Yahya Kemal Beyatlı is writing 1920s occupied Istanbul. While I was finishing my fieldwork in 2013, I happened to attend a lecture that was organized by a foundation, Vakıf, known as the Siyer Vakfı. So this Siyer is a genre of Islamic writing that narrates the histories of the Prophet. The idea, usually these are sort of instructive lessons, stories and what it means to be a good Muslim. And so the head of that foundation comes and gives a public lecture in the Mosque of Eyüp Sultan. So he sits before everybody and he kind of, he sits before this large audience there. I was sitting outside the mosque at the time because they'd set up screens so you could actually sit outside the mosque and listen there. It's also recorded on YouTube. You can find it there. And so he tells a story of Khalid bin Zayd, you know, similar kind of contours. But there were some interesting differences and a couple of the differences that stood out. First, this is part of a project that the foundation was doing of finding a sahabe for every il, every province in Turkey. So 82 provinces, 82 sahabe. So what they've gone and done is sort of found a companion of the Prophet or a companion who's ostensibly buried in each one, and then use that to sort of tell a new kind of story. But that framing assumes actually a very particular kind of geography, which is the geography of modern Turkey. So in contrast, Yahya Kemal Beyatlı is telling a story about Khalid bin Zayd, where we don't yet have Republican Turkey. Instead, in 2013, Muhammad Emin Yildirim is telling a story that is very much still set within that kind of framework. And a second point just to think about is the ways in which this 2013 lecture is very much sort of part and parcel of a then emergent sort of set of civil society discourses where, you know, this is at this point a decade into the rule of the Justice and Development Party and really kind of an expanded public visibility of Islam. So thinking what it meant to tell a story of Khalid bin Zayd, he was addressing a different kind of public in 2013 than Yahya Kemal Beyatlı had been doing in the 1920s.
Well, that's very interesting. You know, I want to come back to the AKP era, but we have now, so we have this example from about 1919, 1920, and this example from 2013 that you give. In your book, though, you argue that the 1950s, so right smack dab in the middle of this, is one of the most important periods for telling new stories about Eyüp, for rethinking connections between people and places in Eyüp. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, I mean, this is work that you yourself, I think, have been doing a lot on. Yeah. This is for people who are doing Turkish studies right now. I think there's a lot of interest in the 1950s as a sort of inflection point. And I think a number of things are happening, right? So there's a demographic transition. The 1950s is where we start to see a generation who was born and raised in the Republic of Turkey. That generation starts to come of age and become increasingly visible. Meanwhile, you have generations of, say, writers who were adults, young adults, or in their 30s in the 1920s. So that generation who had grown up under the Ottoman Empire and who had kind of lived through the trauma of the Balkan Wars, who had lived through the trauma of World War I, the trauma of occupation, the trauma of just the far-reaching violence of the 1910s. That generation starts to pass away in the 1950s. A couple people are really passing away earlier, but there's this moment of sort of demographic transition where a new generation is sort of coming to the fore. And the set of writers writing in the 1950s, there is a group, at least that I was reading, who are, I think, reflecting on what it means to be aging and approaching the end of one's life in this moment of rapid change. So a demographic transition. We have, of course, the political transformation of the transition of multi-party democracy beginning in the 1940s, but really in the context of the 1950s. We have new sort of economic relations, and Gavin Brockett has told this story very effectively, and the ways in which that creates the possibility for new sort of cultural consumer markets. And then we have the far-reaching urban transformations as you have large-scale rural to urban migration to go with the massive urbanization, the massive urban transformations of the Menderes projects. So the transformation of Istanbul by bulldozer and the building of the large boulevards that now define the city. So all of these things are happening in the context of the 1950s, and I think they create this interesting anxiety about places like Eyüp, because Eyüp had been associated with sort of not the unchanging, but with a kind of a density of the past, a density of things that had seemingly stayed the same. And so I think Eyüp becomes an interesting object of discussion in this moment.
Are there any writers from the period who particularly you find particularly interesting from the 1950s?
All of them. No, I mean the 1950s. They're all great. Some of the essays that I love the most, Sermet Muhtar Alus, he's a writer, a folklorist. He is writing. He has this amazing essay about the toy keepers of Eyüp. But it kind of involves him, kind of wandering. Eyüp was known, of course, and is known for the mosque at its center and the tomb at its center. But just, you know, a 2-minute walk outside the mosque was a small street known as Oyuncak Tüccar Caddesi, the Toy Makers Boulevard. And, you know, this was the mosque has always had an association with young boys who are about to be circumcised. And so the idea, you go, you take your son to pray, either right before their circumcision, after their circumcision, and then would often buy them a small toy. And so the toys are, you know, traditionally made of wood, made of clay, small little things. And he has this incredibly vivid and evocative description of sort of walking by and looking at the toys that are being sold in the market and saying, you know, these are tin, these are plastic. And I think he flips one over and is like, made in Germany stamp. And it's this kind of interesting moment of dislocation or disorientation to think about the ways that Istanbul's or that Eyüp has been changing. And I think he finishes and he's walking back in the direction of the ferry and coming to the shore. Here's a couple of young men kind of talking very loudly in the way that young men do outside of a cafe about the dance that they're going to go to. And they're singing, you know, whistling a tango or something like that. And so again, these kinds of points about change, both change in the built environment, but also change in the social landscape, is one of the reasons why I love that essay.
Well, yeah, I think that's a very nice example of what as someone who was interested in 1950s Turkey, I particularly liked that chapter and a lot of the examples you have. And I hope people who read the book will also pay particular attention to that chapter. But let's move forward though to the 90s, which is I think after the 50s, the period where you really see there being these new stories and new buildings that try to change the relationship or rethink the relationship between Islam and the population and the public. So during the 90s, as you said, the AKP or the predecessor parties come to power in a lot of the Istanbul municipalities, AYP among them. So how did the victories of sort of self-consciously religious politicians in a place like AYP lead to changes?
Yeah. So I think that the 1990s are this really interesting period. But before we get there, it's also useful to sort of step back and understand a little bit about the ways that Istanbul's urban governance is reorganized following the September 12th, 1980 coup. So what happens is they reorganize, they create the system of the Büyükbelediyesi, the sort of greater municipality, the metropolitan municipality, and then the İlçe Belediyeleri, the sort of district municipalities. And so AYP becomes one of those. As this is happening, you know, AYP up to that point had really been become a working class district. The Golden Horn had been more or less completely filled in with factories, with workshops, with depots. And those business establishments had become sort of core to the social and cultural life of the district. You know, workers would come down and they'd work on the shore. The day would end. They'd kind of walk back up the hill to wherever they were living on the slopes or on the sort of like inner districts.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
All of those were wiped out in the 1980s, thanks to Bedrettin Dalan. At that moment, he comes in and he wipes everything out. He moves industry to the peripheries of Istanbul. And that creates a real question for AYP. Like, if AYP is no longer going to be a working class district organized around these factories, what kind of district will it be? And so one of the things that immediately happens is saying, wait a minute, we have this opportunity to appreciate all of the this Ottoman heritage that is here. AYP's Ottoman heritage can be rethought and restored in a way that will turn this into a tourist district. And so you have a variety of small projects in the 1980s. People like Zeynep Ahunbay actually does a restoration project that shows up as part of an Aga Khan kind of conversation about Islamic cities. Someone named Nezih Aldem, a really well-known architect, comes and joins the planning office, the newly established planning office in the municipality. In the early 1990s, there's a project in which the History Foundation, the Tarih Vakfı, and Doğan Kuban actually go about trying to put a restoration project for the district as a whole. So there were a number of sort of projects in the works for ways to restore, rehabilitate AYP and sort of turn it, recover this Ottoman past. But then we have the election in 1994. And that both changes things, but it also leads to new kind of opportunities. And so as, you know, in talking, I don't know if all this makes it into the book, but what happened is the 1994 election aligned the district municipality, the metropolitan municipality, who was then led by Recep Tayyip Erdogan, and had access to funding at the national level. And so in short order, the municipality, who had had all these plans but not had the money or support to go about enacting them, goes about restoring all of the buildings they can as quickly as they can. So this often leads to things like tombs or cemeteries, medrases, tekkes. These are all, because they're state property, there's an effort spearheaded by the local municipality to restore these as kind of like highly visible demonstrations of the sort of the efficacy, the value of what the district municipality could do. But this is absolutely allied to a cultural, religious, political project of the then welfare party, Refah Partisi, in the 1990s, which had a lot to do with, you know, countering what they saw as the rejection of the Ottoman past, where the Ottoman past had been rejected by the Republican People's Party. What they were doing is instead recovering this true Ottoman Muslim heritage that had been left to rot. And so again, here the built environment becomes a really important part. So again, this is, I think, a pretty clear example of how building stories work, is the municipality goes about restoring these buildings to say, like, see, what we're doing is we're recovering the true Eyup that had always been here, that had been left to pass away or rot away. And so it did very important political work for them. The mayor at the time, Ahmed Genç, won election in 1994, 1999, and 2004 again. So he was really quite a popular and successful mayor, in part because he had done such an effective job at sort of presenting himself as this protector and custodian of Eyüp's true Ottoman and Muslim identity.
And in the case of Ahmet Genç, I was hoping maybe you could talk a little bit about this this fountain, I guess it is, right, that he leaves behind as his legacy in the district. I found that particularly interesting.
Yeah, so if you are lucky enough to be able to go to Eyüp and are walking from the mosque itself, and you want to go up to the hill, which is known as by some people as the Eyüp Sultan Hill, Eyüp Sultan Tepesi, but is known by many other people simply as Pierre Loti. Before you start taking the stairs going up the hill, you will see a fountain right at the corner. And the fountain written on top of it is Ebedi Eyüp Sultanlılar, so the eternal Eyüp Sultanlı. Residents of Eyüp, the inhabitants of Eyüp. So first, there is a self-conscious shift to calling it Eyüp Sultan and not Eyüp, which is, again, part of the debate over names and identities that I sort of touch on in the book. And what they do is they kind of write all of the people who have been buried in Eyüp. And so in this, by being buried in Eyüp, by virtue of this, they've come to be sort of the eternal residents. But as I learned in doing the research, this fountain actually had a contested history. Like a lot of cemeteries, if you go to cemeteries in Istanbul, you will often find the headstone makers, the mezarcı, will have small little shacks where they basically do their work, small little business establishments right at the edge of a cemetery. And so where that fountain is today had been a cemetery, a mezarcı. And what Ahmet Genç does, according to the stories that I read, is he basically uses his authority as the mezarcı didn't want to give up their spot, or there was basically a struggle over inheritance. And Genç used his authority as mayor to basically work a set of connections to expel the mezarcı from the spot. And in his place, he builds this cemetery, or builds this fountain. Just next to the way, if you pay attention, is his family plot. Is his father, the last time I went, his father is buried there, and you can kind of see that as well. And then there's this neat thing that there's an inscription written in Ottoman, which is itself interesting and noteworthy, at the top of the fountain. And if you, again, are in Istanbul, you see this is a very characteristic thing for Ottoman era fountains, is they'll have the inscription, oftentimes referencing the patron who builds them. And it'll say some sort of, something to do with why the fountain was built, what a beautiful fountain this is, what a charitable and pious person the person who endowed it is. Think of them, pray for them as you're drinking from this water. And Ahmet Genç's fountain does something very similar. Praising him for making such a beautiful fountain, drink the water in good health. And as you do, keep in mind Ahmet Genç and his piety and thank him as you're drinking water as you go along. So there's this interesting history in the 1990s that I think is there in plain sight, but isn't always as visible when we sort of first walk through and wander through the district.
Well, so this brings us up to the present day, I suppose. I think for listeners, I hope we've done a decent job of giving some sense of the variety of things you cover in talking about sort of the pre-AKP era, the 20s, the 50s. But when we come up to the present day, one of the things I thought was particularly interesting to read in your book is the way you, I think, maybe challenge the way we sometimes talk about or think about present-day Istanbul as this period of 20 years of AKP dominance, Erdogan dominance, and how there's just this sort of one vision that's being put in place. And what I got from your book is that there's still, in a place like AYUP, all these competing stories and competing understandings and debates people are having about, you know, what it means to be Muslim, what it means to be a Turkish Muslim, what it means to be Turkish. All these things are still being discussed in AYUP, and I think you do such a good job of showing these different issues people are debating. So maybe we can look at some of them, and I was hoping we could look at especially the way you talk about the Ramadan festivities and the way people think and discuss those.
Yeah, thanks for this question. So I was lucky enough to be in Istanbul for two Ramadans during my fieldwork. And so the first was fell in 2012, the second fell in 2013. And beginning actually under Ahmed Genç in the 1990s, the AYUP municipality had spent a lot of time and effort turning AYUP into a Ramadan destination. And so, if you spend time in Istanbul during Ramadan, you will see various municipalities, usually the sort of conservative ones affiliated with the AKP, with the Justice and Development Party, will organize public Ramadan events. So Sultan Ahmed is one very big example. You'll go and the Fatih municipality will have a huge, you know, spread of things, of shops and performances and this and that. And something similar happened in AYUP. But in 2009, the mayor changed. And so Ahmed Genç had been term limited out. He had served his three terms. And so they brought in a new candidate named İsmail Kavuncu. Kavuncu, when I was there in doing fieldwork, was widely known as being affiliated with the Gülen movement. And so that sort of became a running story it was in the background of the work that I was doing, is sort of these debates about the ways in which people affiliated with the Gülen movement had come to transform parts of AYUP. So a variety of buildings under Ahmed Genç had been turned into public libraries, for example. These were state-owned properties that had been leased to the local municipality, and they turned them into a library or a cafe or some sort of public institution. Under Kavuncu, many of these places had actually been turned into for-profit establishments. So they'd been turned into hotels or restaurants. All of this means that when we come to Ramadan, because AYUP is so important and so popular, there's a really powerful profit incentive at work. You can make as much in a month sort of running a shop or running a small restaurant in AYUP as you might in a year elsewhere, even though you're paying really exorbitant rent for that month. And so it becomes into a profit generation for both the local municipality who's selling the right to use these things. And it's also an important business opportunity for various restaurateurs and cafe owners. But this, of course, raises really all sorts of logistical issues, like should people eat in public? It raises questions of class. People who would want to come and have a nice Ramadan iftar at a nice restaurant overlooking the mosque might not want to look out in the square and see, basically the working class people who live in surrounding districts coming down to have their iftar in the big meydan, in the big square in front of the mosque. Logistical issues dealing with, how you negotiate people coming to have their iftar in the square, and then the ways in which municipal staff and mosque staff would want to clear the square to open it up for the supererogatory prayers, Tarawih prayers during Ramadan. You know, the questions of, how do we relate to our neighbors who are fasting, who might not be fasting? In 2013, the municipality heard all their critiques about what had happened in 2012 and it sort of swung back the other way and set up a lot, building these arcades modeled on the Ottoman era arcades in the Kaaba in Mecca. And again, for some people, they really liked the ambiance, but for other people, they looked at this, they said, this is a show. It's like, it has no meaning. It has no substance. So one of the things that I think this shows is that the debate, the fault line in Turkey or in Istanbul, isn't simply between a sort of religious way of life and a secular way of life, but rather you get these really kind of complicated debates between Muslims about the ways in which being Muslim requires or carries with it certain expectations about how you relate to the to your neighbors. And again, hopefully the chapter sort of, I think one of the things that it does well is makes visible sort of the range of perspectives and experiences that are located in Ayyub during that month of fasting.
And you know, not just at Ramadan, but around the year too, you talk about the issue of the visibility of women, female worshipers. And partially that's because of the size of the crowds, but also because of the layout of the Ayyub complex. It creates these issues of visibility that also are being debated. So perhaps you could talk about that too.
Yeah, and this is something that I touch on. I didn't do maybe as well as I know they're thinking. So Sevgi Adak has written really wonderfully about gender and Islam. And then also Gökçen Beyinli Dinç has also written wonderfully about sort of the gender and pilgrimage and ziyaret in Eyüp Sultan in particular. So I kind of wanted to mention them as people who have really done a much better job than I have of kind of thinking through these questions. But because the tomb is one, you see just greater numbers of women visiting the tomb, the visibility of women in the mosque in the first place is larger than it might be in a mosque like Sultan Ahmet, in a mosque like Süleymaniye, for example. So you get this kind of visibility of women visiting and praying in the mosque, and a sort of density of visitation that you don't necessarily see elsewhere. But that crowd, like the numbers of people, actually, again, raise particular issues during Ramadan because Ayyub becomes so crowded. And so the question of should women pray in front, how you maintain those norms or do not maintain those norms. One of the stories I tell in the book then is the differences between madhabs, whether you're Shafi or Hanafi, actually have really interesting consequences for how gender is negotiated. So if you're in a Hanafi tradition and you do your ablutions, it doesn't necessarily matter if you're a man and you bump into a woman on the way to perform your prayers. Like that isn't going to violate your state of ritual cleanliness. In contrast, if you're educated in a Shafi tradition, and you're a man, bumping into a woman can pollute or kind of make you lose that state of ritual cleanliness and force you to do those ablutions again. And so obviously in a crowd, you're going to bump into people. And one of the things that I realized is that, again, the ways that those sort of gendered interactions have actually interesting and important consequences as people are moving through this kind of densely packed space in the month of Ramadan.
And also, I mean, not just Ramadan, or maybe not even particularly Ramadan, but you talk about the signage and the language that's around Ayyub. And I also found that very interesting too. And so maybe we could finish on talking about that a little bit.
Yeah. When there's, I will answer this question. I wanted to raise one other kind of really clear example about sort of the ongoing debate over these places and meanings. But your question about signage, you know, it's all over the signage, very specifically instructing women. Here's the proper way to dress. Don't wear tight pants. Make sure you're covering your head. And it is, again, it's speaking to the what I call like the rules of place that operate, that these rules of place are going to operate unevenly. And gender plays a really important role. Women's bodies, not surprisingly, are policed in a very different kind of way than men's bodies are, which I think is connected to sort of broader gender dynamics about broader geographies of gender, of gendered Islam in Istanbul in particular, and more broadly in Turkey and the world more generally. So I think that's part of the story, is really this emphasis that the mosque staff, the local muftu, or municipality staff as well, will make to sort of do this. But again, in Ayyub, it's different than neighborhoods like Fatih, or some of the sort of more conservative neighborhoods of Fatih or various places, just to share a caricature about Fatih. But as somebody, who was then working for the municipality told me, we're standing there and talking during Ramadan and we're looking things out. And he said, you can't find this openness and range of things. So I do want to say that Ayyub, there are restrictions and there are norms and expectations about how women should cover themselves or dress as part of an act of pilgrimage. But again, there's, I think, a broader spectrum of dress than you find in some of the other districts of Istanbul, which I think is a reminder that Eyüp has been and will continue to be an important Muslim pilgrimage site. But the ways in which that Muslimness is understood and in sort of embodied and inhabited as a form of dress are always going to be open to sort of debate and negotiation and plurality. So there's, I think that's a useful thing to remember about Eyüp, is that it's not a single type of being Muslim. It's not a single type of dress. The other thing I wanted to, hopefully, if I have a minute or two, is just talk a little bit about is the ongoing transformations to Feshane. So Feshane is an important building in Eyüp's 19th century history. It is founded by the Ottoman state as part of the Ottoman Empire's attempt to modernize and industrialize. So it becomes a really important, as the name suggests, factory for the production of the fez, and will later on expand its production to textiles more generally. Under the 20th century, it is a crucial industrial linchpin of the district's economy, of Eyüp's economy and sort of social life. The state-owned, the public company that runs the factory is privatized and sells off Feshane. And so in the 1980s, the municipality faces this question of, well, what do we do with this building? There is an attempt in the early 1990s to learn from the example of cities like London, which had, again, gone similar sort of economic transformations and had turned its former industrial sites into new cultural centers. So the Tate Modern is an example that's referenced. And there's a brief attempt to turn Feshane into Istanbul Modern, what would become the Istanbul Modern Art Museum. It fails for a number of reasons, in large part because the 1994 election brings this to a close. The municipality at that time tries to turn it into a sort of nostalgic Ottoman marketplace. It doesn't take. By the time I was doing my fieldwork in 2011, it was instead being used for a variety of cultural fairs and various memleket günleri, district days for, as Giresun days or Hatay days. It was being used for sort of various fairs like that. Eventually it closes. And it's just the building sits there. And when I was finishing the book, there were rumors that it would turn into a museum of Sufism, but the 2023 election or the when 2019 election happens, and İmamoğlu comes to power. And instead there's an effort to turn the building into a new contemporary art space, which is what it is now. This is something I've written a little bit on the UC Press blog. So if people are interested, they can find some. And more or less immediately, you have conservative religious groups complaining and seeing the building as spreading LGBTQ propaganda. Their efforts to – they've appealed to the Istanbul prosecutor to basically convict the curators on the part of inciting the public to bad morality. Very much caught up in the contemporary moment of politics, it seems inescapable that this is going to continue to be debated in the lead up to the municipal elections next year. But it is a reminder that the debates over places and their meanings and how these buildings should be used continue to be an ongoing struggle. Then they are not fixed and are worthy of our ongoing attention.
Well, I'm glad you gave that Feshane example as well, because it really does speak to the range of interesting examples that the book contains. And I think it goes to the fact that we only covered a small amount in this discussion. In particular, there's a chapter you have about water and the way it also connects people, and stories about water and ideas about water connect people and places as well. So for that and for many more things, I think people really should go and read the book. Knowing that you have a background in English helps explain the flowing literary quality of the writing at times. I thought it was excellent. And that leads me to my last question, which is simply, what topics, what questions are you turning your attention to now?
Yeah, a couple of different things. First, thanks for the kind words about the book. It is a book, hopefully, I hope it speaks to a number of audiences, but really for people who know Istanbul, I hope they are able, they read it and they recognize an Istanbul they know, but learn to see it from a slightly different point of view. So I really hope that the book speaks to that. And I'm incredibly grateful to UC Press for making the book available open access. So anyone can download it to their reader as a PDF. It's available for people to read and share as they see fit. In terms of where I'm going from here, a couple of projects that I'm trying to balance. I think I'm going to continue to write about the geographies of Islam. So I've written a little bit recently about the cultural historian, writer, intellectual, doctor, teacher, Ahmed Suhail Inver. So I think Inver's work is, he spends a lot of time in Ayupa throughout his life. So his work becomes is something that I want to continue to work with as part of, a broader conversation that is happening right now in the discipline to rethink some of the paradigms we have about how to study Islam in 20th century Turkey. The second thing that I've been writing about, although I've stepped back a little bit from it, is the aftermath of the 2016 coup attempt and the ways in which that coup attempt or the resistance to the coup attempt has been commemorated in a variety of ways, including websites, books, various media, and particularly through these sort of memorial landscapes that show up all over Istanbul, including in Eyüp. And then the third thing that I'm trying to do and trying to work through is very much inspired by a recent turn within both geography and Istanbul studies, sort of, we could say, the environmental turn. And I've been trying to write about trees. And so there's a particular species of tree. The Latin name is Ailanthus altissimo. The English name is the tree of heaven. In Turkish, the polite name for it is kokar ağacı, also Ailandos. But there's another name for those who know me, it comes, there's more vulgar name for the tree that often smells quite poorly. But trying to figure out how does one write a history of this tree that is everywhere in Istanbul, including Eyüp, but doesn't really have an archival record. So I've been trying to think like, how does one write something interesting and meaningful about this tree that is very much an urban tree, but doesn't really show up visibly in the lives of the archive. So it's a question I'm trying to think through.
Well, that sounds fascinating. And I mean, I don't know. I'm hoping there's maybe a scratch and sniff type book that could be produced out of it even, you know?
Sounds great.
Yeah. But again, thank you for talking about your book. It's a really wonderful book. And yes, as you say, it's easily accessible to anyone who hears this, is interested and wants to read it further. So thank you very much.
Ruben, thanks so much. Thanks for such a generous set of questions and the opportunity to join you today. So I really appreciate it.